This past weekend, the National Park Service reopened a section of a scenic route that was closed due to the damage from 60,000 earthquakes linked to the eruption of Kilauea volcano. Access to Byron Ledge and Devastation Trail is another milestone in the long road to recovery. Today, we pause to reflect on the impact that event had to the community, the island, and the state. We recently talked to Star Advertiser's Christy Wilson and photo editor George Lee about a new book out. Fire and Fury is the title, and it compiles not just the drama that played out against the changing landscape, but it puts in context the last 35 years of Kilauea's eruptions.
As the eruption went on, we knew that we were going to have something, but we needed this thing to end before we could even start a beginning. The original idea that Mike Rovner had was to do just the May through August eruption, and then he decided that why don't we make it the 35 years from the 1983 start till the end of August of 2018.
And you had a team of photographers out there covering it.
Yes,
we utilized
our freelancers until we could get out there. We had set up a rotation system where everybody had to go, from the most senior of our photographers to the most junior. And even I spent a couple weeks out there documenting what was going on out there.
Yeah, the paper even, we rented a house in Orchidland, which is in Puna, not far from Pahoa Town. But I think for the paper, it was probably the largest ever deployment, longest ever for sure, of continuous staff. So we had actually had people, reporters and photographers, on the ground for at least every day for at least 2 months, I think, before they started.
Yeah, we would go a couple of days before we could, like, platoon people in and
out
there.
So that's what we were doing. Like, we'd platoon people, like George said, we'd use that term. We'd bring people in, and then they'd rotate out and then rotate back, and new people would come in. But we actually ended up having to rent a house. Just, it was close to where the action was and was a little more economical.
And we started in Ina Loa, at a vacation rental. And then we'd move to Orchidland.
I mean, that smart idea, because that was your base camp.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It was for me as a veteran reporter, it was kind of, I always hesitate to use the word fun, because obviously there were a lot of terrible things that happened to a lot of people out there. But it was really an amazing assignment for me. And to be back in those situations where you have a lot of camaraderie, not just with your own people, but, you know, there was a whole team of TV reporters. I mean, international people, national reporters. And it was just, it was energizing to be covering that story, but also to be among this crew of people. And, you know, we were all decked out in our flak jackets and wearing our hiking boots. And it was kind of rugged, but it was also
helmets,
just, yeah,
gas masks.
Yeah.
I think, too, that was the scary part, right, was the fumes, like, because they were warning people that, we don't know where it's coming, and you just don't, you know, if you're in an area that should be off limits, it's for a reason.
Right. The sulfur dioxide and certainly the lays in the air, so the change of the wind can bring that stuff over you. And even when you were where you were supposed to be, you could still taste it in the air.
Were you ever, like, really scared at any point?
No, not really. Self-preservation, I think, kind of kicked in. For the most part, we were escorted by the National Guard, and they would always forward deploy a team, measure the air, figure out what's going to happen, which way is the wind blowing, the whole nine yards.
What about for you?
Yeah, it was the same situation. By the time I got there, the National Guard had set up regular, they had daily convoys, actually, where they would bring in media. And, of course, this was to prevent people from sneaking in and wandering where they weren't supposed to go, into a hazardous area. So it was very controlled, but they did get us pretty close to the action, and you could hear it, the rumbling. You could hear the constant, you know, noise from the, especially when Fissure 8 started, became the dominant vent there. And you could see it. You could, like George said, you could smell it. You could hear it. It was really pretty amazing. But I'm not sure I ever felt in danger. I think at the beginning, the first few days before there was any kind of news infrastructure set up, some of our reporters, I mean, you were at people's houses in their backyards where the lava was shooting up. And it was it was going off, and there wasn't that much control over the media. So that was kind of, I didn't experience that. But yeah, but I think they came back pretty with some pretty good stories.
Well, I think when I think when vacation land was claimed, right? I mean, when all those homes, hundreds of homes overnight, and then I think to see Mayor Kim, I mean, that was pretty emotional to know
right.
that the depth of loss in that community and the resource was just staggering.
One of the things illustrated very nicely in this book is, yes, you have wonderful pictures taken by the photographers of, as Cindy Ellen Russell terms, dancing lava. But I think what this book also illustrates is the stories of the people coming together to help out each other. The hub in Pahoa Town, where people were coming together for information, for clothing, for food, for support, to teams of animal handlers going out to get horses and goats and cattle off the lands, and just what it took to save these animals, you know, because they're assets. It's a farming community. We would see it, sometimes they were successful and sometimes not, but I think the evidence is in the work.
So, like, how many pictures did you have to sort through?
With the book as a total, we looked at probably about 3,000 images to cover the 35 years, and certainly thousands of frames were taken in that 3-month period in 2018, certainly by our guys. Of course, we're also drawing from freelance photographers as well as the National Park Service, as well as the Volcano Observatory, whose work appears here, as well as the wire services also.
I just think, you know, what a bear. I mean, you're just having to edit down. You know, what do you leave out, because there's just so many stunning images.
Mike and I commandeered our large meeting room in the news, and we just printed out the whole book, and we just started to arrange pages and then gather chapters together. And we just kind of got a good idea about the flow of the book. It is set in chronological order, but then you still have the task of having to, again, what are we going to emphasize here?
And so how did that work, Christy? I mean, so did the pictures drive the narrative or what?
Yeah, I think to me, this book is really, even though I wrote the copy, I wrote the introduction, and then I think there are 6 or 7 chapters that cover different phases of the Pu'ul eruption, which started, as George mentioned, in January 1983. And then when that vent actually collapsed just 3 days before the start of the Leilani Estates eruption in Lower Puna, that period of the Pu'ul eruption ended, and then this new period began, which was actually considered a separate eruption, but yet they all involve Kilauea Volcano, and that's the span of the book. But I think, to me, it was, like I said, the pictures tell the story. And in the copy, what we tried to do was describe the geological events as they happened, why they happened. But at the same time, I went through our newspaper archives, I went through our stories, and tried to put in some human stories, quotes from the people at the time, you know, kind of eyewitness accounts, just to give it that more complete picture that it, and I think George touched on it, the book itself, while there's these spectacular photos of lava fountains and flows and all this amazing photography, there's also a lot of photos of the people who were impacted and at their rawest moments. And I tried to do that in the copy, but the book also isn't just the pretty pictures of lava. It tells the human story and how the people were impacted.
Well, when you talk about lava, I mean, it's death in some instances, but it's also life, because it's the earth, right?
Right. Yeah, it's a natural process. And the other thing, too, that came across was, because I did a story on the people of Volcano, and while the lava was flowing down in Puna, Lower Puna, you know, they had all the explosions. They had a series, like I think 60 or more explosive events at the summit.
Yes.
And the ground there, that's where all the earthquakes were happening. So the people in Volcano, and it had come to kind of go off at clockwork about every 24 to 28 hours at one point. So they were dealing with that, like there'd be these earthquakes, at least one big earthquake a day, plus a bunch of little ones. And so, you know, they were dealing with that, and I did a story just focusing on them. And so there was just so much going on. And then I also went to Ocean View, which is around, you know, South Point and up the coast, where the VOG was the worst. And they had, the Department of Health was having community meetings up there, because the VOG there was, people were waking up and their cars were covered in ash. And I mean, and they weren't anywhere near the eruption. So, you know, the impacts were far and wide.
To hear the term lava bombs, you know, for the folks that were injured, whether you were on the that lava boat or, you know, the one gentleman that was, I think,
on his lanai.
Right. And he got injured.
There is coverage of the lava boat, and I do believe we do have a picture of the of that gentleman who was injured.
I think we have a picture of the woman on the boat from her hospital bed. Yeah. So that was, I know, that was really amazing. And in fact, and I think we may have photos of the lava boat too. And then we also have some of the photos that were taken from the water looking at what the coastal entries looked like, which was really spectacular too.
Okay, so I have to ask now, do you have a favorite photo? I know it's the worst thing to ask a photographer, right? Because there's so many images in here that, you know, you look at the texture and then you look at the human drama, you know, of people's expressions on their faces.
Yes, I think this project literally, I think it shot itself. It really, really did. The professionalism of our staff, their dogged persistence of, you know, chasing the story down, just really comes through. And I think you really see their heart for the community and for the profession. You know, really, really comes through here.
And what about for you, Christy?
There's you know, like, it's just really hard because there are suspects. But there's a couple. I know one that Cindy L. and Russell took that's at the very beginning of the book. And there may be another one kind of like it, but it's not really showing any lava, but it just shows it's a desolate road and the trees are all defoliated and it's just the sky is orange and it's, you know, there's these billowing clouds and you can see the glow of the fissure that's backlighting these barren tree trunks. And to me, that one of my most vivid pictures are in my own mind that I saw was just the glow, the whole sky, the whole picture is orange. And I just remember, no matter where you were in Pune, like in Pohoa, where you were still miles from where the fissure was, or even where we were staying in Aina Loa at night, you still saw this glow, like this glow, and just, it just never stopped. And it was, I just couldn't, that was the one thing I just couldn't get over, was just that orange glow that just, no matter where you were, how close you were, how far, it was there and it was just a constant presence. And these photos kind of remind me of that. And it was kind of hellish. I mean, it was kind of a hellish image. And these two photos, I don't know who took that one. Was that by Cindy too?
Also, yes.
Yeah, there's that just kind of really remind me of what the experience was for me.
I just remember seeing the cracks in the road and just thinking, wow.
Yeah. And I remember one of the fun stories we did, and you know, we were out covering the volcano and then we were talking to people who had, you know, lost their homes, and that was so sad and so tragic. But I remember Andrew Gomes went out, and he was there, he did two or three stints, but he went down to Uncle Robert's in Kalapana. And, you know, the Wednesday night market, and that he did, like, that was still going a Wednesday night, and where people would dance, there was a band, there were booths. But I remember the road going down there, and they would put up signs saying warning, you know, but there were still cracks in the road and the steam was just coming up out of the ground. And yeah, you're driving over those newly opened cracks. It was a little, you'd kind of step on the gas to get over as fast as
harrowing.
You could, but we were still going to Uncle Robert's.
Life goes on.
Right?
Life goes on. That was the Star Advertiser's Christy Wilson and George Lee talking about the book that the paper has just released. For information about where to get the book, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.